All right, so, you know, I actually took off my Harry Potter costume and put this on, wiped off my scar for y'all, but now I see we're probably a friendly group. I probably could have stayed in costume. But some of you probably think I still am in costume with Harry Potter. That's fine. Right. I tell you, I wiped it. But I had a co-presenter, but he couldn't make it through from the East Coast. But just to give you a little bit of background, I'm with an organization called Youth Alive. We're a organization based in Oakland. We do youth violence prevention and intervention. So we think that young people are not the problem. We think they're part of the solution, and they have the innate capacity to help solve the issue of violence. And I'm going to talk a little bit about one of our three programs and then the national network that we've built with replication programs based on this model. I don't know how familiar folks are in here with the concept of hospitals being part of preventing violence. Who here has sort of seen that before? Okay, so a little bit. I'm going to talk a little bit about that before I really get into the study. I have no disclosures to make. So just to kind of ground this, I'm going to talk a little bit about Pablo, who was, we changed his name, but that's one of our real clients. Pablo was a young man who lived in a gang-affiliated neighborhood of Oakland. Both his two older brothers and his father were affiliated with the gang. He ran with the gang sometime. It's not really clear what he was involved in, definitely tagging, some kind of petty crime, possibly with some shooting. But he wasn't heavy into the gang, although this probably sounds like, on the scale of things, he was sort of one foot in, one foot out. But his brothers and his father had been. He was standing outside of his house one day with a friend, just talking. And he wasn't wearing gang colors or anything like that, but he was, in front of his house. And a car drove by very slowly. And he noticed it, and what he noticed was sort of a little too late to do anything about it. Someone leaned out the side of the car and shot out six shots. He doesn't know to this day if he was the target, or if the house was the target, or if his friend was the target, but the six bullets that shot out, three of them caught him. One in the back, one in the chest, and one in his leg. At that point, he got rushed off to the nearest hospital. When he got there, his friends and family came to join him. They said they had some thoughts about a rival gang that may have been responsible for the shooting. They wanted to get some descriptions about who he thought it was. The tensions were very, very high. In the meantime, the doctors told him that, there was a chance he was never going to walk again. Into that setting came a young man named Raymond Estrada. Ray is an intervention specialist with a program that we call Caught the Crossfire in Oakland. It's a hospital-based violence intervention program. That's the type of setting that that these programs work in. So today I'm going to tell you a little bit about hospital-based violence intervention programs. I apologize for the acronym, but we have a lot to it's a very long thing to spell out, so that's what that stands for. Talk a little bit about whether hospital-based violence intervention is effective, what the need is for violence intervention at hospitals here in California, what some of the gaps are, what trauma centers are doing to prevent injuries in general, and why more trauma centers don't have this type of program. And then also when we look at it sort of as we look across the landscape of the state, sort of what we can do to remove some of these barriers. The purpose of hospital-based violence intervention programs is to promote positive alternative violence and reduce retaliation, re-injury, and arrest. Okay. So when people say, "Well, why this population?" Because it's a chance to actually intervene. We call it a golden moment, a point in life when someone wants or need help, and they want their life to change, but they may not know how. Because the point where often retaliation gets planned, so there's that sort of that immediate threat of violence if you don't intervene. There is not just sort of before you leave the hospital or while you're at the hospital, but support after you leave the hospital. So what's special about intervention programs as opposed to something that only happens at screening at the hospital is because unlike most social workers and of course doctors, you can't actually follow someone out of the hospital and help them with that reintegration, often back exactly to that community, even maybe the home where the violence took place. The mentor case managers, they have different names in different cities, are community members. So in some sense, it's like a community health worker model. To give you a sense, I said that we're part of a national network. This is a national network, has 21 members in a bunch of cities, and we share our best practices with each other through different forums. We have a conference. We do some research together, promote policy. So I wanted people to sort of know what that is in case you were looking for resources or if there's resources in your community or near you that you'd like to meet. We've produced a book that's a best practices guide, so it helps existing programs, but also if you're a new program that wants to start, you can get this book. It's available at nnhvip.org for free if you just want to download it, or you can also order a hardbound copy there. These are all the programs that are part of the network. This is a nice big screen, so you can probably see them pretty well, but it's 21 different programs, it's a little more than 20 cities that we're in. So we're sort of spread across the country. I'm going to hit on this, but there's something else I want to hit on, which is that, let me go back for a second. I said, so why do we have these types of programs? They're all across the country because there was a nationwide study done, and I'm sorry, I don't have the citation here, but they found that for young people, it's people in their teens and 20s, if they are shot and they go to the hospital, a retrospective study showed that 44% get shot again, right? So almost half the young people that get shot end up back in the hospital. That's part of the reason sometimes we talk about stopping the revolving door. If you talk to doctors and nurses who work in EDs, these emergency departments, they'll tell you they keep seeing the same people and how frustrating that is. There's a really high incidence of recidivism. The same study that showed that almost half the young people are going to come back with another gunshot showed that 20% eventually die by violence. So if you end up in the hospital with a violent injury, there's a 1 in 5 chance that's how you're going to die at some point in your life. These are the current hospitals in California that have hospital-based violence intervention programs. Several of them are run by us. There's also a program here in San Francisco, a program in Los Angeles, run by a gang intervention organization there, in Contra Costa County, and then there's two in Sacramento. Oh, here's the data I mentioned before. So this is the same study. So this is the Sims and Bivens, and then there's been follow-up studies done on this about the number that are actually injured that return. Okay, so I'm going to tell you a little bit about the effectiveness of hospital-based violence intervention. So we did a study of our program. It showed anecdotally that there was no retaliation, immediate retaliation. 98% of the clients stayed injury-free, and they were 70% less likely to be arrested. So we were reducing both re-injury and perpetration. There was a Milwaukee study done. Milwaukee is another program. Ours began in 1994. Theirs began a little later that same year, and they work at a children's hospital. And so they didn't have a control group, but they found that they had a 3% recidivism, which again, 3%, much better than 44%. In Chicago, there's a program. This is not the Ceasefire Cure Violence program. It's actually another hospital there. They did a study, and again, they showed that the folks that received violence intervention had a much lower recidivism rate, 8%, as opposed to the control group, which is 20%. That's within a year. The largest and probably best study of the effectiveness of hospital-based violence intervention is the study that was done in Baltimore with a program called the Violence Intervention Program there, or Baltimore VIP. And so this was probably the best study because they actually did a random assignment of control group. So this was Dr. Carnell Cooper. And what he found was, this has to do with perpetration, so there were fewer arrests for violence, fewer convictions for violence in the group that received the intervention or receive violence intervention services. Then they went on to show that the savings, basically what they saved in terms of incarceration costs because of the value of the program. I always thought this was interesting coming from California to see that they were estimating the cost of incarceration as $25,000 a year. I know California would love that to be the low cost of incarceration, but that's definitely not where we're at here. So imagine if this reflected, you know, whatever the cost of incarceration is wherever you are, you could see this is, you know, $600,000 saving for just working with, for, you know, 50-something people. So it definitely saves money for in terms of criminal justice. But, you know, we know from public health, right, we often talk about savings of things, and what always frustrates me is we talk about the savings, but the people that reap the savings tend to not be the people that invest. So I think what's interesting is when we talk about, well, if a hospital invests in this program, what do they save? So this is actually looking at reinjury. And so what they found was that the injury recidivism was significantly less with the intervention population, so 36% of the folks who didn't receive the services came back with another violent injury, and only 5%, right, came back with another gunshot of the people that they did work with. And so what that, you know, meant in terms of savings, right, was fairly significant. So actually this can be a very cost-effective program if a hospital invests in it. So, I'm trying to go back. I have the number somewhere, but it's about 200 something thousand was the cost of the program. So they were making significant, you know, money back for the hospital. So that's sort of just the picture of sort of do these programs work? Are they effective? And there's actually more studies than that, but so that was sort of a quick look at what the studies show in terms of effectiveness. So then the question was, you know, we thought, well, let's look at all the, let's look statewide and just look at our home state and see what we can find in terms of what's going on in terms of violence and whether these programs can be effective. So we looked at all the injury data across the state, and then we did surveys and interviews with trauma center staff. And like I said, the goal was just to sort of see what the need was, what opportunities there were, and then what the barriers were that people said to establishing a program that, you know, as we showed, can be effective both in reducing violence and in saving money for hospitals that invest in it. Is this all good? So few of you in here. Feels so quiet. We're good? All right. So these are the counties that actually had published rates of violent injury. We calculated that by just looking at hospitalizations, both fatal and non-fatal. So Lord knows what these colors actually look like here. Everything looks orange to me after being outside. But basically these are ordered sort of in terms of most to least in terms of rates of violence. So, you know, this half is the half that's in the top half. And then everything, from Kern down to Monterey, those are the counties that were above average, right? So, you know, above average and above the median. And so we sort of said, let's forget about the ones on the far side and just look at the top half. And then even with the top half, we started to sort of say, which ones have sort of the highest need. And then just for folks that are interested in sort of don't know the county names, the biggest or the city with the highest the highest number of violent injuries is put here in case you don't know what all these cities and places might be. So, like for example, Monterey. Monterey is really the biggest city there, but Salinas has got the most violent injuries. So you have a sense of sort of what the urban centers are there. So this is more data. We broke it down. I sort of said, you know, here's the non-fatal hospitalizations and the fatal hospitalizations. We sort of add those up, and we're interested in two things, not just the rate was interesting to us, but also the number, right? There has to be some kind of economy of scale to make it worth investing in spending time doing violence intervention. And so then we split these up, and we said there's, you know, sort of highest priority places with, you know, basically a lot of injuries and a high rate. High priority would be a lot of injuries, but not quite as high of a rate, and then, you know, medium was sort of the rest that were still above that that threshold. So we contacted, there was 48 eligible trauma centers in that group. Finding contact information was really hard. You would think that the state had a list of all the trauma centers and who their contact people are. They do not. That was a fun talk. So there's no single list. So that took a lot longer than we thought. So we actually only got responses, like contact information, for 38 that we could actually send a survey to. We had 24 survey respondents and 11 interviews we did. There's a little glance at the, you know, who participated. It was pretty decent distribution across. Not all of these counties had trauma centers. We only interviewed level 1 and 2 trauma centers. So not all the counties had them, which was in itself something interesting. We talked to them about just sort of what the numbers they saw, what they sort of saw in terms of their violent injuries, what they did for injury prevention in general, and then specifically about violent injury, to see if there was there was something different there, and then sort of what their interest was in doing violence intervention. It's probably not super easy to see, but the blue is the total number of trauma patients, and the orange is the violently injured patients they see. So, some folks saw a lot of violent injuries because they saw a lot of injuries, and some saw a high proportion of violent injuries. So Oakland, unfortunately, was one of those that saw a high proportion. Children's Hospital of Los Angeles was interesting to me. That was another high proportion of violent injuries for their total population. So I'll move along there. We talked to them about injury prevention in general. They should have someone assigned to do injury prevention. That's part of its trauma center certification. And so what we found out was, less than half had someone who was a full-time employee whose job was to deal with community injury prevention. And of those full-time folks, even of those full-time people, only one of them was their full-time job doing injury prevention, right? So everyone else has like 1.5 million. Then of the other people that were less than full-time employees whose job was injury prevention, most of them had a lot of their jobs other than injury prevention too. So very rarely was there someone who a majority of their time or, you know, was thinking about injury prevention of all types. Then we asked them about what they're doing in terms of injury prevention. So these were the types of programs they had. Violence prevention intervention. Remember, these are the trauma centers who are have the highest rates of violence. Violence prevention intervention was fifth in terms of how common it was as an injury prevention concern. So, alcohol, driving, bicycle safety, child passenger safety, fall prevention, that was all much more common. And then we said, why don't you have any hospital-based violence intervention? What's the barrier here? And so the number one answer, and you probably guess this, they said it was money. And then they said it was staffing, which, I guess we saw some of that staffing and why that might be. And they said it was time. And really, they didn't, they said there was maybe some interest level, maybe the administration wasn't interested or the doctors weren't interested, but there was nobody who said the nurses or the patients weren't interested. So we had sort of a few answers along there, but really it was, money, time, and staffing were the main barriers identified. Although then when we talked to them further and we said, well, then what do you need to start doing violence intervention in your hospital? They didn't say funding, right? They did, but the number one thing they said was they just needed more information, which was sort of curious that was their answer. This was from the survey. So number one answer was best practices information. Number three answer was technical assistance, which is an interesting way of saying, if we knew how to do it, the money wouldn't be the barrier. Same thing when we talked to them in an interview. We said, if you really could have more information, would that be more important than having, funding? And again, at this point, when we actually started doing interviews, funding dropped down to the fourth most common type of assistance requested. So it was really like learning more, having data, having mentoring. So this was sort of not what we expected. But money's still an issue. So in terms of what we learned, in terms of these highest need counties where there's a high rate of violence and a large number of injuries, only 6 of the 31 trauma centers were doing violence intervention. There was 3 more that were developing programs, and the majority of the rest actually were interested in developing programs. Four counties had no interest at all. 2 of them were pretty large counties, Kern County and San Diego County. You might remember Kern as being at the top of the violent injury rate. No interest in doing that any kind of prevention, violence prevention. That's where Bakersfield is. And then 2 of these counties, San Joaquin and Monterey County, had no trauma center at all. So I mentioned Salinas earlier. Part of the reason there's so much, Salinas is actually the homicide capital, youth homicide capital of California. That's a terrible thing to be number one in. And part of the reason is because there's no trauma center. So when young people get shot there, they have to get flown to Stanford Hospital or UCSF to get taken care of. I mean, similar things in the high priority and medium priority counties in terms of, but here we had even less existing programs. And in these counties, there was no one who was developing programs. So, you know, some of the sort of things that blew us away was just, you know, like I said, mentioning how some of those violent places had no trauma centers at all, how there was so few, even in the places that had trauma centers, how so few of them had violence intervention programs, but that there was interest, right, from the majority of survey respondents. That the barriers were hospital buy-in. That was something that 20% of folks said. That violence prevention was not the top priority for these trauma centers. There was a desire to include this as a requirement for certification, or at least a recommendation in the Green Book, which sets trauma center certification requirements. So the trauma centers would have to do this, do violence intervention if they had a lot of violent injuries that they saw. Some of this we talked about. I'll move on. But one thing I will point out, people said, you know, stakeholders, if there were stakeholders that sort of bought into it, that they thought others would follow, which I think goes back to, you know, that when they said funding was the issue, but then they said what we really needed was data. Like, we just need to convince the right people on staff. Recommendations after this survey, we thought we needed to really further disseminate some of the resources that we've developed as a network so people understand this model, that we should work with the Committee on Trauma to promote this as something that trauma centers are required to do for their certification. And finally, this funding issue, that hospitals need to have sort of a long-term, sustainable funding source. Two things to think about. One is, and there's been a lot of talk here, is, you know, are community health workers or promotores going to be reimbursed through Medicaid? If they are, then, you know, could these workers that do this violence intervention be considered that? Then the other piece that's sort of unique to violence is this idea of victim of crime reimbursement. There are a lot of issues nationally around this and in the state as well. A lot of the folks who need this money to support them are not eligible because the system is basically racist. It doesn't allow for people who have records in some states. If a police says, you know, like this Pablo who got shot, you know, he was in a house that had a gang tag, then it becomes he's a gang member officially, and then he can't get any money to pay for his bills. So that's part of the issue. There's issues around eligibility that need to be solved, and then around service coverage, so it might pay for your medical bills, but it doesn't necessarily pay for your mental health or your paraprofessional services that you require. So I'm just going to end with sort of telling you how Pablo's story ended. So the gangs and the guns in the hospital, you remember that piece. After that, what happened is Ray took him every day to all his clinic appointments and to physical therapy. Eventually, Pablo learned how to walk around, and he actually got on crutches so he can move around and doesn't have to live his life in a wheelchair, which was his fear. Because of the trauma he experienced just going back to his home, eventually he worked on getting relocated. And got assistance. Basically, Ray was able to connect him with victim of crime, following up, helping to change the police report so he could move out of that house and somewhere where he doesn't have to think about getting shot. And he actually went to school, and Pablo is now studying because he says he wants to be a juvenile hall counselor. He feels like he would have a good influence on people that were like him. So that's it. There's contact information if you want to learn more.
Quite interested in it is that We recently held an event in Scotland where we had David Kennedy there and we had Gary Buckton there. And I'm sure they always circulate the same events, but it was kind of an interesting opportunity.
They may try not to, I don't know.
Couldn't ask them. Hey, no. The thing that struck me was that actually, when you listen carefully, the approach that I'm advocating are less different than many people can be to them. But if there is a difference at all, it's probably around the degree of engagement with the police.
Mm-hmm.
And I can kind of see it from both sides.
Sure.
See the argument. You know, I mean, I guess if you were simplifying it, you know, Gary would be saying, look, just stop the killings. If that means you almost create a parallel system, who cares? Stop the killings. Whereas I guess what David Kennedy was saying is, okay, well, you somehow at some point have to bring those two things back together. You kind of need the police and the interrupters to work together. So, sorry, this is turning into a rant on my question.
It's good rant, though.
How do you work with the police?
Sure. So, both Boston and the Chicago Cure of Violence, as it's now called, both are members of a network. So hospital-based violence intervention is compatible with both models, however you think about them. In terms of working with police, it varies across our network members, how closely they work with police. But I would say in Chicago, it's really very little intersection. But the commonality is that all the programs, when we work with police, the information flows in one direction, from them to us, and not the other way around. And so that, you know, and if you've been in violence prevention circles before, you've heard people talk about how hard it is to build up that trust with police, especially when you're bringing in maybe, Ray, he's a former gang member, felon, he's someone that the police had a different relationship with before he became someone in this field. And so, that takes some trust building. But it's really essential for a few things. One is around this issue of, because victim of crime is one of the few resources for people, really working with police to make sure we get police reports, to make sure the police reports accurately reflect and don't negatively reflect upon the victim so that you can get access to those resources. And then another thing is a number of the programs in our network, including ours, do homicide response as well. So the same sort of idea that after an incident, maybe you're not gonna, you obviously can't prevent that victim, that victim's already gone, but the family potential for retaliation there. There's sort of two levels for potential perpetration after a violent incident, right? One is the real obvious, like there's retaliation being planned right now. So you want to calm tension so that doesn't happen, that sort of interruption model. And then the second is this sort of more long-term approach, which is that we know that the experience of trauma and being repeatedly traumatized affects you psychologically and biologically and makes you more likely to do things like carry a gun for your protection because you're feeling paranoid or be hyper-aroused all the time so you're jumpy, so you're more likely to get in conflicts. And so you're more likely to be in harm's way after being traumatized, even if you're not necessarily retaliating for sort of what that initial violent incident was. So that's something that we do is respond to homicides for that reason as well. And police are essential in that for next of kin information or planning around the interrogation and how that affects the family. And so I don't know if I answered your question, but it's an important relationship. But I think the most important thing is that you have to establish an understanding that the information only goes in one direction. Otherwise, your workers are unsafe. If people think that you're talking to the police, we can't go into these homes.
I think the study points to a bigger issue, which is that I think it's a mistake to believe you can have sort of a violence intervention program within an institution without the infrastructure of social workers and mental health teams.
Yeah.
So what this means is those don't exist. I mean, I've been in the trauma center actually in Chicago, and I think it's too narrow to believe if you have ceasefire or stop violence intervention worker that is. And I think it's a mistake that without understanding sort of the everyday reality, the clinical need, that if a young man has to leave his community, mm-hmm. he's safe. But we can't say anything, as the inspired does say, it won't speak about the social inequities. Not to speak about the social inequities that makes a man have to leave his neighborhood to be safe, or leave his neighborhood So I do think that it's somehow looking for an expansion of this discussion,
mm-hmm.
because you can't have a ceasefire worker in your hospital without a mental health team, without some team, because they're sort of just roaming around. So I do think that
this correct.
Points to a bigger issue.
That's correct. At the trauma center in Chicago where they work, they have a close relationship actually with the pastoral workers there. So you know all this. And you're right, it works. These programs work best when you have real connection and buy-in between the social workers at the hospital and sort of a long-term case manager, not an interrupter, right? There's interrupters sort of come in, come out, but they don't do long-term work. You really need someone who works long-term with the young person, because it's there's a lot more than just the injury or the retaliation. There's the whole, the societal inequities, right? The community they were born into or raised in, where they'll have issues around education or employment or the experiences around them.
What kind of community coalitions do you create within the, let's say, person who's story sharing?
Sure.
Establishing a coalition.
I'm not sure I understand the question. Sure. So there's some different models within the network of that. So I could talk about Oakland for a long time. We do a lot of that. But like Milwaukee is another example. They do a lot of work where they connect their young people to youth leadership as well. And so they actually, train young people to go through their program to also give back to the community. They put on different events like Christmas events, soup kitchen events, et cetera. They're sort of involved in a whole array of pieces. In terms of community organizing, we do a youth leadership, same idea, where we train youth to use their experience to speak out about, what things they think will actually make a difference in the community in terms of violence, or sometimes it's as specific as sort of like, how the schools can do a better job of being sensitive to the fact that, if a kid misses school because they've been injured, that's not a reason to, hurt their grades. So there's been a lot of... some of these programs have done a lot of work on sort of using the voice of the young people who've been injured to speak out, if that answers your question. Yeah.
Just to touch on that, my name is Sharon, and I work for the Center. We're a wraparound provider in San Francisco that works with the social program. And that's like what you're speaking to is exactly that, like connecting to either a nonprofit or a community. Having a little wraparound program is really crucial because we're with mental health.
Yeah.
Living in home and with the family. And we've worked with several youth that have been in the same situation, and they had to move for safety reasons. Most often, kids are foster youth, and the home that they're living in is now, 7 days notice, I don't have a kid here, I'm staying at my house, so little staff at another placement just to provide that in-home support, safety planning, and also getting their mental health needs met. And along with that, case management, too, for the family to kind of, continue on with the care. And most often, our services are average about 11 months time, but we work really closely with the hospital social workers and county workers. That's the connection to that.
Yeah, and, that's something all the, this work is too hard for anyone to try and do it alone or to try and do something that someone else can do. Referrals to mental health, referrals to, immigration advocacy. There's all kinds of networks that we rely on. Our specialty is holding the hand of the violently injured person and getting them where they need to be to recover and to not retaliate. Yeah.
So, I think that the evaluation data from all the different cities, it's impressive. I'm curious about, are there core elements across all of these programs you wonder about fidelity of a program.
Sure.
If you're trying to put that forward, what are the core elements and kind of the conceptual framework behind, the model that's put forward, and how replicable is it, especially when you talk about different towns, different rural communities,
mm-hmm.
which, tend to be the lower end of that
yep.
list, but are just as important.
Yeah. So the core elements are responding as quickly as possible after a violent injury to the hospital bedside or as soon as possible afterwards, having pre- and post-discharge services, having the intervention specialist or case manager, whatever they're called, be someone who is from the same community that the person is from, that there be a streamlined referral process. So sometimes the person works for the hospital or not, but that there be a streamlined referral process, and that the we have sort of standards around level of intensity, but sort of basically no more than caseload size of 20 and at least 6 months of follow-up. So there's still tons of variation even within that. You know, if it's something you'd be interested in looking at, like I said, that book is free online, so you can download it, and it basically has examples from all of the sort of original seven programs. So you can sort of see the different flavor they put on it. You know, like I said, like in Chicago, they integrate them really, you know, significantly with the street outreach. You know, in other places, it's not that type of model. But
and that document that you mentioned, it does sort of capture the best practices that you've been able to compile with the system.
Yeah.
Okay. Cool. Great presentation.
Thanks.
Yeah.